All right, we're going to start on the top of Kuf Aleph, Amud Aleph. We begin, we're discussing the Mishnah, where a tree moves for whatever reason to someone else's property, that there is some sort of contribution by both parties. And since there's a contribution by both parties, therefore, the Gemara seems to indicate that they might actually have to yachloku, they have to split the proceeds or split the output of that tree. So this is the case here. Shatav Nar Zitav. Here the river came and washed a tree away from one person's land into the other individual's land. When it washed it into the other person's land, the question is now, first of all, who's causing the tree to produce the fruit now? Was it the tree that was planted in the first individual's yard, or is it the land in which the tree now landed? The Gemara says, or the Mishnah had said, Yachloku, which seems to indicate that they're both contributing factors to the growth or the production of the fruits that come out from there. So Amar Lula, Amar Eish Lakish, Lo Shanu Elish Nekru Begushehem. The first consideration here is this is a din in Orla. The din in Orla is that if a tree is uprooted and then replanted, if the tree is totally uprooted without any of the dirt in which it is currently growing and then replanted, the Shnota Orla start over again. The 3-year camp Orla starts over again, and then the fruits would be asur for the first 3 years. So the case in the Mishnah must be a case where the tree, when it was washed away by the flood, also took a gush afar, took a bunch of the dirt that it is growing in and moved with it. Because when it moves with the dirt that it's growing in, that preserves the years of Orla that have already been counted for that tree. That's number one. Ula achar shalosh. And it's also after 3 years, meaning that the tree left this person's field and then planted itself in the new field. Now, our Mishnah is discussing a case when it's already been in that field for 3 years, in the new field for 3 years. Why? Avo betoch shalosh. For the first 3 years that it is in the other field, hakol shel bal hazeitim. It belongs entirely to the owner of the tree. Why does it belong entirely to the owner of the tree? Darmalei. Had you planted a new tree starting today, you would not be able to eat these fruits for the first 3 years. So the only reason that you're able to eat fruits right now from the, or anybody's able to eat fruits from this tree, is because I planted it in my field for the previous 3 years. So it's clear that my contribution here is what allows us to eat fruits for the first 3 years. So he says, according to Ula, in the name of Reish Lakish, then the Baal HaZeitim is entitled to everything for the first 3 years, and then after the 3 years, yachloku, then they'll split it for after that point. So Mar says, well, why doesn't the owner of the field say back to him? Vele milei, I ano nate, had I planted the tree myself, l'acha shalosh avachino lei kule. He says, listen, you're right. For the first 3 years, I would have eaten nothing. But after 3 years, I would have eaten everything. So hashto ka'achol palgo b'hadai. Now I'm splitting the half. I'm splitting 50% of it, of the output, after the first 3 years. So if I'm splitting the 50% of the output after the 3 years, I should be entitled to at least some of the output in the first 3 years. Ella, so this is another possibility or another interpretation of what Reish Lakish said. Ki at the Ravin, I'm Reish Lakish. When Ravin came, he said in the name of Reish Lakish, rather, lo shanu elosh nekru begushehen. He agrees that the tree has to be moved with its dirt, because otherwise, again, the years of the Orla would be reset. If the years of the Orla are reset, there's nothing to talk about here, because the fruits are not able to be eaten for the first 3 years. U betoch shalosh. That's within the first 3 years. For the first 3 years, they split the output. Avaliacha shalosh. After 3 years, akol balakarka. Everything goes to the owner of the land. Dharma Lake, because the owner of the land could say to this individual, I ananatai, had I planted myself, acha shalosh, milava achilnele kule, if I had planted myself, I could have eaten the entire tree, the entire output. You did not help me. You did not help me at all with anything that comes after 3 years. What you did help me with is for the first 3 years. Had I planted myself for the first 3 years, I would not have been able to eat anything. So in that area, we split, because you contributed to the fact that I'm able to have fruits in the first 3 years because of your tree. But after 3 years, I could have replicated whatever is here now. I could have replicated myself by planting it myself. So Gemara says, well, le malay, why doesn't he say back to him, the owner of the tree say back to him, iat natat betoch shalosh, had you planted for the first 3 years, lo avachalt, you wouldn't have eaten anything. But now you get to eat a half, 50% of the output for the first 3 years. Meaning that had you done this yourself, you would have gotten zero for 3 years, and then you would get everything afterwards. Now, the way we're setting up our Mishnah, at least according to Ravin in the name of Reish Lakish, for the first 3 years you get 50%, and then afterwards you get 100%. So why can't the Baal of the tree say to him, listen, I'm contributing to you for the first 3 years 50%, so I should get something in the back end as well. Gemara says, no, because Mishum Darmalei, I ananatai, true. Had I planted it, I would not have been able to eat any of the fruits, but hava ketina vizarana techutayu. Had it been that, silka v'yarka, had it been that case, I would have taken the, underneath the tree, or in the area that the tree takes up, I would have planted vegetables, or either beets or spinach, I would have planted underneath the tree. Why? Because in the early growth years of the tree, the branches and the leaves don't create such a shade, and therefore you could plant vegetables in that area because there's enough sunlight for them to grow. So had I planted for the first 3 years, true, I would have gotten no fruits out of the olives, but I would have made up for that by having vegetables be planted underneath. Now that your tree is here, it landed here, and I'm able to eat for the first 3 years, but I'm not allowed to I'm not able to plant vegetables anymore because your tree is much more developed. Your tree is more developed. There's too much shade to grow any vegetables over there. If that's the case, I'm losing that ability to plant the vegetables. So in lieu of that, I take 50% of the fruits for the first 3 years. But afterwards, it all belongs to me. And as you can see, we pass on the halacha this way, but Rabbi's interpretation of Eish Lakish, which is that this idea of Yachloku is only for the first 3 years, but after the third year, it all belongs to the Baal HaKarka. It belongs solely to the Baal HaKarka, because he could have replicated having a tree there by planting it himself after 3 years. And the fact that he gets a portion of the first 3 years is not... does not give the right to the Baal HaZeitim to get something afterwards, because he can argue that it's in lieu of the vegetables I would have planted there. Now, the Gemara. For the actual. You're asking me for the actual tree. Alright, so Tosfos asks your question. Tosfos says exactly what you're saying, David. If you look in Tosfos, VMR Halaz Zeitai. So he says, Afal Pi Shalachar Gimel Koshal Balakarko. He says, Ubalakarki Yitain Dmea Zeitim. He still has to buy. He would have otherwise have to expended the money to pay for a right plant. He has to pay to keep the tree, meaning that he got a fully developed tree now that it's going to produce peyrot. So Tosfos says exactly what you're saying, David, which is that he has to compensate for the tree that he's getting, because otherwise he would have to buy at least a shatel, right, at least stole something. He would have to buy a shtila and put it in the ground. So now he's getting away with not having to pay for that. So here he'll have to compensate the Baal HaZeitim at least for giving him a fruit tree that he otherwise would have had to purchase. So Enochanam. Sure. So the question is, when the tree lands in the field, we have two periods of time. We have the first 3 years, and then after 3 years. Why is the first 3 years significant? The first 3 years are significant because they are the years of Orla that are now being, right, deferred or not happening at all because the tree came with its afar from another location. So Ula and Ravin argue about who has the better claim here, who has the more rights over here. According to Ula, it's the Baal HaZeitim. The Baal of the tree has more rights here because he provides a tree that now can be eaten for the first 3 years. So in the first years, he eats everything. The tree owner eats everything because he provided all of that. Without him, there would be nothing to eat for the first 3 years. After 3 years, they split it because now both are contributing. The Baal HaKarka and the Baal HaZeitim is contributing. On the other hand, Rabin says, no, the other way around. For the first 3 years, they split it, right? But after 3 years, the Baal HaKarka gets everything. The owner of the land gets everything. Why? Because the difference, or the way Rabin's learning, is that the Baal HaKarka could simulate what is taking place here. If you had planted his own tree, after 3 years, he could eat. So now that someone else's tree landed here, after 3 years, he should be able to eat all the fruits as well. So when they split it, it's only in the first 3 years. That's the contribution of the Baal HaZeitim. Now, why did we reject Ula? We rejected Ula is because there's two sides to the story. Ula said, wait, if in the first 3 years, the tree owner gets everything. In the back end, they split it. So then the Baal HaKarka, the owner of the land, comes back and says, listen, had I planted my own tree, after 3 years, I could have eaten everything. Now I'm splitting it with you, then you should have to give me something in the first 3 years. So that's the problem with Ula. So the same issue arises with Ravin, which can say the same thing. The tree owner can say, listen, you're splitting it with me for the first 3 years, even though it's really all because of me that there is anything in the first 3 years. So I should get some stuff in the back end. To that, the Gemara answers no, that in this case, the Baal HaKarka is actually giving something up in the first 3 years. He's giving up the ability to plant the vegetables there. And so in place or in lieu of that he gets compensation of 50% of the fruits for the first 3 years. But after 3 years, since the Baal HaKarka could have replicated this and planted his own tree, then he gets all the produce. Now, David asked the question, which Tosfos addresses over here, is that he can't just, you know, goes to the Baal HaKarka and it's free. No, he has to pay. He has to pay for the tree because he would have to pay to plant his own tree also. So we ask him to compensate the Baal HaZeitim, but the output or the production will belong to the Baal HaKarka from that point forward. Okay? All right, so now the Gemara asks the basic question, which is, what's the scenario that took place here? A flood came, washed the tree into the other guy's land, right? And now we have a problem because they're both contributing to the growth or the output here of these fruits. Well, what would be the simplest solution? For him to go in and say, let me have my tree back, and I'm going to go put it back in my own land. Why can't he take his tree back and put it back in his own field? So that's the problem, right? The Gemara takes it as a given that he can't do that. Why is that? So the Gemara says, Tano, Amar hala zeitai ani totel. He says, listen, I'm coming to get my tree back. I want to take it back. Ein shomim lo. We do not permit him to do that, which seems to be the underlying assumption of the Gemara. My time. What's the reason he can't go and take his tree back? So Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Shuv Eretz Yisrael. We don't allow you to uproot a tree because of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah Kedugon Da Tzricha Rabo. He says, Rabbi Yirmiyah says about this statement of Yochanan that we need a great man like Rabbi Yochanan to tell us this because it's not misvara. It's not necessarily a logical conclusion. Why? I mean, he's not planning on uprooting the tree and then taking it somewhere else. All he's trying to do is move it from one place and move it to another, back into his field. So if you're talking about Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, in some sense, it should be equal. If he takes the tree out, then he puts it down right in his field. But nevertheless, Rabbi Yochanan says, Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, we don't allow you to move the tree. We don't allow you to take it. Once a tree is planted, we leave the tree wherever it's planted, and we don't move it. You know, we have similar idea. The Gemara in Bava Basra is a similar idea by Beit Knesset, by a shul, right? Exactly. That one is not allowed to be oker a Beit Knesset in a city, even though they're planning on building another shul. You can't be oker the first Beit Knesset. So there again, but the Gemara there talks about, the Gemara gives different reasons because of Pshia, because of other reasons. But I'm saying over here, you could make a claim that they have the same issue, which is that even though technically he's trying to uproot it to put it into his field, if something happens, then you could fail in Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. You could make such an argument. But if I was to say logically, right, the difference between oker a shul and building a shul is different than just taking a tree from the one field and placing it in the other field, I think you could argue that this would be not so logical. And that's why Rabbi Yochanan, we have to have Rabbi Yochanan tell us that this is because of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to move the tree. Right now, we have a new case. It has nothing to do with the Gemara, but it's a similar type of idea, so therefore it's brought over here. Tanan Hatam, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, HaMekabel Ste Me'avutav Min HaNachri. Person who gets a field of his forefathers from a Nachri, Maaser. He has to take off Maaser, V'notein Lo, and give his production to the Nachri. Okay, Savrua. So the Gemara says, what's going on here? I wasn't clear about what the mission is, and that's what the Gemara is going to explain. Savrua, my steal vutav. What does it mean that it's steal vutav over here? Eretz Yisrael means a field in Eretz Yisrael. But my karle steal vutav. What does it mean, steal vutav? Stay Abraham, Yitzchak, V'Yakov. I mean that avutav, not literally his parents or his grandparents, but steal vutav means of our forefathers, right? The field of our forefathers, which means that it's found in Eretz Yisrael. Vika Savar. And the underlying assumption of this, or this position of Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, is Ein Kinyan LeNachri BeEretz Yisrael LeFkia Miyad Maser. That number one, that even when a Nachri takes possession of property in Eretz Yisrael, that does not change the fact that one must be Mafrish Masrot. If a Jew is the one who ends up with these fruits, they must be Mafrish Masrot. Number one. And number two is Mekabel Kechocher Dami. All right, now I'll explain the Mishnah. The Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda is talking about a case of a person who's coming to work the field of the Nachri. The Nachri owns the field. Now, a Jewish farmer is coming to work the field. Now, in order to work the field, he is not a sharecropper here, but he's rather a chocher. A chocher, as opposed to an aris, when it comes to a sharecropper and aris, you pay a percentage of the output of the field to the owner of the field. In the case of a chocher, you pay him a fixed amount per year. No matter what the production of the field is, whether you plant the field or don't plant the field, you pay him a fixed amount per year, you know, 50 bushels per year, irrespective of what percentage that is and irrespective of whether you plant the land or not. So the case here is that this farmer, this Jewish farmer, is a chocher to the Nachri. So now what happens? He plants the field. At the end of the year, he owes the farmer he owes him a bunch of money. And when he owes him a bunch of money at the end of the year, what does he do? He takes all the production of the fruits and vegetables, right? And if he takes all the production of the fruits and vegetables, he part of it belongs to him, and part of it he's now going to pay to the goy. So what the Mishnah says, according to Rabbi Yehuda, is first he has to take off maasrot on the entire production. After he's taken off maasrot from the entire production, then he pays the nachri. All right, so now the question is why? What's going on here? So the first thing that the Gemara says, the assumption is that ain kinyan le nachri be'eretz Yisrael v'giya miyad maser. Number one is that a nachri doesn't have the ability to remove the chiyuv maser. Therefore, the entire property is chayav in masrot. Number two is umikabel kicholcher dami. A mikabel, someone who works the field as an aris, as a percentage or as a sharecropper, has the same din as someone who pays a fixed amount per year. Ma hocher. Ben avad, lo avad, whether he works the field or doesn't work the field, baye surei umeitan lehe. First he has to take off masrot and then pay his debt. Dechiporeah chovato dami. Right? So when he pays the money to the owner, he's paying him his debts. And you can't pay your debts with tevel. So therefore you must take maaser off first and then pay your debts. So the same thing over here. Same thing by a mikabel or an aris. The same af mikabel nami ki porea chavoto dami. So therefore, a aris, a sharecropper, even though he's paying a percentage of the output of the field, right? Nevertheless, it's considered as if he's paying off a chov. That means that all the production really belongs to the farmer, and then afterwards he's paying a part of that to the balabayit. So when he does that, he's paying off an obligation. He can't use tevel for that. So therefore, again, maser venotein lo, he has to take off the masrot first and then pay him off. So this is the Gemara's Havamina here of how to explain the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah. The Shita of Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah is premised. I'm reading the Gemara now like Rashi. We'll go back later and see that Tosfos, reads the Gemara slightly differently. But according to Rashi, the issues, there are two things, there are two assumptions about this. One is that when it's a Nachri that owns it, there's still an obligation to pay Masrot, number one. And number two is that if you are an Aris, if you are a sharecropper, you have the same din as a Chocher, the same din as a fixed payer. In the fact that when you pay the owner, you're paying a debt. If you're paying off a debt, you have to pay your debts from grains or produce that is mitukan, that already has the masrot removed from it. Based on that, the conclusion of Yehuda is that you have to take off maser for the entire production, and then only afterwards pay the nachri. And that will mean that you lose, because you are actually paying the masrot on even the nachri's portion, and then paying the nachri. So the Jew is going to lose out over here. Your question's a fair question, which is how could you ever compare a sharecropper to a hocher, which is one's paying a fixed fee and the other one is paying a production. Well, your argument is the Gemara is going to come around to your understanding, which is that a aris is different than a hocher, and that when it grows, it really belongs from the beginning. That percentage belongs to the owner. The Gemara will come around to that. The re, maybe because of your question, interprets the Gemara slightly differently, and we'll come back and we'll look at the re in a second, okay? So now, Amar le Rav Kahana the Rav Papi, Vamar le Rav Zvid, people say it was the Rav Zid, Elahad de Tanya, what are you going to do with this brisa? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, HaMekabel Ste Avutav, again, here's someone who is working the field of his fathers, Mi Meitzik. Now here it's not from Stam, from any Nachri, it's from a Meitzik, who is an Anas, someone who is an extortionist, someone who is a strong man who comes around and steals fields from the Jews, takes it and then makes them buy it back. Meitzik Nachri, Maser v'notein lo. He has to take off Maser for the amount and then notein lo. Where it says, Ma'iria Meitzik, Afilo ein Meitzik Nami. Meaning that why in the Braisa is Rabbi Yehuda only saying his din about a Meitzik? Whereas we know, based on the way we explained the Mishnah before that Rabbi Yehuda was mentioning, it's independent of whether he's a Meitzik or not, he has to pay the entire Maser. So why does the Braisa limit Rabbi Yehuda's din to a Meitzik? So it must be that our explanation of the Mishnah before is incorrect. Ah, what is the proper explanation? What is the proper explanation of the Mishnah? Ela le'olam, yesh kinyan le'nachri be'eretz Yisrael le'afkia mi'idei maser. So first step, there is a nachri who plants in Eretz Yisrael, no maser. Umekabel lav kechocher dami. David, here's your answer, right? A sharecropper is nothing like a fixed payer. A fixed payer is paying a debt, and a sharecropper, right, the ownership of this hit the percentages percent belongs to the sharecropper, and a percentage belongs to the owner, and that's theirs from, you know, beginning to end, in a sense. Now, Rashi's point over here is that either one of these would be sufficient to say that you're not chayav masrot on the entire field here. Either one in and of itself is sufficient. If you say that an achri owning the land is enough to be mafkia amidei maser, then he shouldn't be chayav maser. Or, even if you say that an achri does not take away the chayav maser, if a sharecropper is not like a fixed payer, then similarly he should not have to pay maser on the portion that he's giving to the balabait. So the Gemara here is giving both, but really it's either or would be sufficient. The Ri, on the other hand, believes throughout the sugya, I'll just do it in summary here, I'm not going to go through the whole Ri, that the two are connected, the two reasons are connected, that truthfully a mekabel and a ris, a sharecropper, should never look like a chocher. Just the Gemara says that in places where they are, where there's a chumra, or there's a where machmir, that the goy does not have the ability to be mafkia the masrot, then we are machmir on a sharecropper to look like a hocher. And in our instance over here, where the Gemara believes that the goy does have the ability to be mafkia the kinyan in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore if there is an obligation of masrot on the hocher, it's only me the rabbanan. Over there, the Gemara doesn't go as far to say that the mekabel, the aris, is like a hocher. So the Ri believes that they go hand in hand, that the reason of kinyan of the Eretz Yisrael of giving masrot will determine whether the mekabel is like a hocher or not like a hocher. Umay steabutav. What does steavotav here mean? Steavotav mamash means literally his family's fields. So now, what's the story now? What's mean? Lididei hu dekansua rabbanan. And over here, the rabbanan were kones this individual. Da'aydi dechavivi alei tvei. Since this field is very beloved to him, why? Because it's his from his family. It was taken away from his family. It's his family's fields. Va'ozil mekabelo. He will go ahead and agree to be a sharecropper on such a field because he feels an attachment to it. He feels an affinity towards this field. Avel inish de alma, regular people, lo. So regular people will not go ahead and take this field. It's a question. It's not clear, at least the way that we're going to explain the Gemara now, according to Rashi and according to Tosus, why the fact is that other people won't go take the field. Lidi day. According to him, my time a kansua rabbanon. Why did the rabbanon kones? Why did they fine him? What does that mean? They fined him. They fined him in the sense that he has to pay maser on the entire field. He has to pay maser on the entire field because I'm Rabbi Yochanan kedeshe bara biyado. In order that the way Rashi and Tosfos learn here, bara means brura, clearly in his hands. We want to force him to buy the field back from the nachri. So what do we do here? So the way Rashi explains the Gemara is here, if we impose the fine on the entire field and said that anybody who works this field that was taken by a metzik, right, he'll have to pay maser on the whole field. Now, who would take up such a field? If we said that everybody has to pay maser on this field, nobody else would ever come and work the field because they're going to get, as sharecroppers, they're going to get a lower percentage than they would get working any other field because they have to take maser on the entire amount. So they would never take such a field. But this individual whose field it was his family's field, despite the fact that he's getting a lower percentage, because of his affinity for the field and because it's, you know, a family, long-time family-owned field, therefore he'll be willing, despite the lower percentage, to take on this field, even though he's getting a lower percentage based on the fine of the chachamim that has to take off maaser on the whole field. But what's going to happen? Over time, he's going to get tired or he's going to get worn down by the fact that he has to pay maaser on the whole field. And because that wears him down, what's he going to do? He's going to work on a way to buy the field back. So, because if he's already paying maaser on the whole field, he may as well buy the field and have it in his possession. So the incentive here, or what the chachamim were trying to do, is push this individual to get the field back into his possession, to bring the field back into his possession. What's not clear here is that the way it's structured is that the chachamim said we didn't impose maaser on any other individual. No other individual had to pay maaser on the whole field because if we did impose it, they would never buy it. Right, so, okay. Or they would never come and be sharecroppers there. Okay. So what if they don't become sharecroppers over here? It's not clear to me what the reason is. The Rabbeinu Chananel, on the other... Right. So what does that do? How does it come back into Jewish hands now? If you have another person who comes as an aris, he's a sharecropper, right? He could work any field as a sharecropper. He gets this field or another field. It's all equal percentage for him. So he's willing to work this field as a sharecropper. He is not incented in any way to buy the field back. So that leaving it without Maaser for other people does not create any incentive to buy the field back. That's what's not clear to me. Meaning that had you imposed Maaser on everybody, then regular sharecroppers would never take it up because they would get a lower percentage. This individual would take it up because it's his family's field, and then the burden would force him to buy it back. I think you'd be in a better situation if that was the case. So the Rabbeinu Chananel explains the word bara not to mean brirura, but bor, like from the word bor and rake, which means to be empty, left empty. So that's the, that, in that sense, it makes more sense. Why? Because we don't want anybody to take on this field. Right, so if the Nachri Nen has nobody who's willing to take on the field, then he's going to sell the field back to a Jew at a small amount of money because you'll find nobody who's willing to take on this field because of this penalty. You see at the end of the Tosfos, he says, Aval acher lo hutzrichu liknos. Other people, they didn't have to make the knas. Ulaser debelav hachi shomeo lanu medekablo. They'll listen to us not to take it. Aval yoresh dechaviv lei lo teil azara. So now, it's not clear to me if Tosfos is making this statement only on the Rabbeinu Chananel, which it seems from the flow, that the Rabbeinu Chananel says, listen, we're going to not penalize anybody else because they'll listen to us and not take it. We'll penalize this individual and then he won't take it, so the field will lay fallow. If the field lays fallow, then the Metzik will sell it back. That's what it sounds to me. But you could argue that that Tosfos means that last statement even on his first piece, which is the intention here is to have the first individuals will never take it because we say don't take this from the Metzik. The other individual will take it from the Metzik because it's his family heirloom. So we impose the Knas so that it'll become a burden on him and he'll eventually buy it back. So you could argue that that last line in the Tosfos applies to both, although it seems more logical according to the Rach, which we're trying to keep the field not to be worked, as opposed to the Tosfos where we want the field to be worked, but because of that to generate an incentive to buy back the field. All right. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah makes the same statement here about Rabbi Yochanan is gagon da tzricha rabo. Over here, we need, this is not something that we would have come to logically, right? This is something that we need like a gavarabo, like Rabbi Yochanan, to teach us that this din about basically something which is another din of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, that din of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, to teach us that this knas only applies to someone who's a stei avutav in order to incentivize them to bring it back to being owned by the Jews. Okay, Itmar. Hayoreid l'toch ste chavero, person goes into his friend's field, v'nata, and he plants it shelo birshut, without permission. Amarav, shamim lo v'yado ala tachtona. We assess how much value he created here, and yado ala tachtona, this is something we've seen in Baba Kama before, which is that when you do something without permission, without against the will of the individual who owns it, then we say you that he pays you the lesser of the expenditures or the shevach, right? Whatever is less here, the benefit that he created to the field or the expenditures that he made, whichever is the lesser of the two, you pay over here. Ushmo amar omdim kama adam rotzeh litein b'stezu l'nota. We assess how much a person would have to hire a gardener in order to plant such a field with the tree, and then you compensate him like a gardener who planted a tree. So now, it's obvious over here that the case is where he wants the field to be planted with the tree, and that's what the Gemara says. Amar papa velo plige. There's no argument between. Right. Okay. So that's very good. So that's a good. Right. Very good. Right. So that's the question. Right. If he doesn't want this at all, David, the Rosh asks your question. And the Rosh says exactly what you're saying, that if he says that I don't want this here at all, he can say to the planter, come in, take your stuff, and get out of here with it. I mean, that the underlying assumption of the Gemara, according to the Rosh, is that this individual at least has some desire to have a tree here. But if he has no desire to have a tree in this field, he can say to him, I don't want you, and I don't want your tree. You take your tree and yourself, and you take it off my field, and that he would have such a right. All right? So now, the Gemara says, Amar Rav Papa, velo plige. They don't argue over here. I mean, it depends on the type of field. One field is designated to be planted with trees, and another field is designated to be planted as a stelavan, planted with produce, not with trees. So now, the difference between Shmuel and Rav has to do with what is the purpose of the field. If the purpose of the field is to plant trees anyway, then at the end of the day, he plants the tree. And this individual would have to hire someone to plant the trees anyway, then we just say compensate him like a gardener as if he planted a tree for you, because he did what you otherwise would have paid for. On the other hand, in Rav's case here, where the field is supposed to be used for produce and he ends up planting a tree there, then again, if the individual in the end acquiesces and says, listen, I'd like, it's okay to leave the tree there, then he pays him the lesser of the shevach or the yitziah, lesser of the expenditures or the benefit, because that's not what the field was designated for, but nevertheless, he is getting some benefit. So we tell him to pay the lesser of those two, and that's the position of Rav. Now, v'had Rav, lav b'feirushitmar, Rav's statement about yado ala tachtona was not said explicitly, ela michlaleitmar, we can infer it. Why? Now, da'atala kamei d'Rav, there's an individual came before Rav, amalei, zil shumle, a case like this, where another individual had come into his field and planted a tree. So he says, go and assess the value of the tree and pay it to him. Amalei lobina, he says, I don't want the tree. Amalei, zil shumle v'yado ala tachtona. Go assess the value of the tree, and you'll pay him the lesser of the expenditures or the shevech. Amalei lo beina. He says, I don't want this tree here. I really don't want the tree. I'm not paying for it. The sof chazio. So the case was closed. The sof chazio da gadro. Become interla. In the end, Rav noticed that this individual put a fence up around the tree, and then he was guarding it. That he seems to mean that he was making some indications that he really did want the tree here. Amalei galita adatech. Right, you made it clear now, denechalach, that you're happy with this tree here. Zil shumle, go pay him, viadoala yonah, and you pay him in full now. Because not only, now you've made it like Shmuel, which is that not only have you not said that, I didn't want the tree here in the beginning, he says, I didn't want this tree here at all. But then, which is what the conclusion would have been, that if he didn't want the tree here at all, he doesn't have to pay anything. Rav, from the indications of Rav, would mean that if he allowed the tree to stay, even though that was not his preference, then he would have to pay shumle v'yadoa tachtona. That's where we get the din of Rav. In the end, he says, he puts up a fence, he starts guarding it. Rav says, well, not only is it that you said, okay, I'll live with the tree, it looks like you really wanted the tree to be here. You're acting as if the tree was the real purpose of, or you're very happy with this tree. If that's the case, then the din's like Shmuel, and you got to pay him like a gardener for putting in a tree for you. Itmar, another case. Hayurei detoch churvato shel chaveiro. As opposed to going to his field, he goes into some empty lot or a desolated area of his friend. Shel chaveiro ubana, and then he builds up the house shelo bershuto without his permission. Varmalo, he says back to him, it's aiva v'nai nitotel. So the individual comes back and says, you know, listen, you know what? It's your field. You're right. It's your lot. I'm going to just take my bricks and my wood back. Basically, I'm going to dismantle the house. I'm going to take it away. Rav Nachman Amar Shomim Lo. Rav Nachman says, we do listen to him. He's allowed to dismantle the house and take it away. Rav Sheshet Amar Ein Shomim Lo. Rav Sheshet says, we don't listen to him. Meitve, Gemara says, Rav Shimon Omer, Beit Shammai Omrim Shomim Lo, Beit Hillel Omrim Ein Shomim Lo. In this case, Rav Shimon Gamliel says that this is a machlokas Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. So Gemara says, Blamer Rav Nachman Damar Ke Beit Shammai. Right, let's say that but Rav Nachman holds like Beit Shammai, which is obviously not good for Rav Nachman, because generally we're going to paskin like Beit Hillel. So let's say that based on the way Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is learning the machlokas in this type of case, that Rav Nachman and Beit Shammai have the same opinion. Rav says no. Who? Meaning Rav Nachman da Amar ki haitana. He holds like this other Tana, the Tanya, we have a Braisa, Shomim lo, Divrei Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Rabbi Shimon Elazar says a statement of fact. That means both according to Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, Shomim lo. We listen to him and we allow him to dismantle the house. Then Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel comes along and says, Omer, Beit Shammai omrim, Shomim lo, Beit Hillel omrim, in Shomim lo. Then he says that it's a machlokas. So Rabbi Nachman says, I'm not going to hold like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says it's a machlokas. I hold like Rabbi Shimon Elazar says that everybody agrees that Shomim lo, that we let him dismantle the house. And that's who I hold like. Rabbi Nachman says that you're allowed to dismantle the house. Gemara says, my havi Allah, what's the din? So I'm Rabbi Yaakov, I'm Rabbi Yochanan, bibayit, when it comes to a house, shomim lo, we listen to him, we allow him to dismantle it. Bisadeh, when it comes to a field, ain't shomim lo, we don't allow him to dismantle, meaning take out the trees, or take out that which is planted in the field. My time, mishum, yishuv eretz Yisrael, because of yishuv eretz Yisrael, this is similar to the statement we had from Rabbi Yochanan above, right, that Rabbi Yochanan said, when you have something planted in eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to be okay, you're not allowed to uproot it. So now where it says, Mishum kichashadaro, that you're not allowed to remove the trees, you're not allowed to remove the items that are there because of the detriment that they caused to land, meaning that the tree being there or the produce that was there, whatever was planted there, diminished or took nutrients out of the land in order to grow. Now, if you're okay, if you take this object out, then the benefit that the land contributed is being removed, and the land's left without whatever it gave towards this item. So therefore, my benayu, what's the difference between these two reasons? Ike benayu chutz laretz. Of course, the difference between them is outside of Eretz Yisrael. If the din is mishum yishuv Eretz Yisrael, that means in chutz laretz, everybody, then Rabbi Yochanan would agree that you can even dismantle, you can dismantle a house, you can uproot trees in chutz laretz because there's no din of yishuv Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, if you say the reason you can't take the trees out is because of kashkicha shadaro, because it weakens the land, then it would apply equally in Eretz Yisrael as it does in chutz laretz. Now, Tosfos asks the question here, and it's a boring question, is that the Gemara here is just repeating the din of Rabbi Yochanan, right? The Gemara is saying before, Rabbi Yochanan said, Mishuv Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, that you're not allowed to uproot a tree. And Rabbi Yochanan is saying the same thing over here, because trees in a Sadeh, trees, you're not allowed to uproot them, Mishuv Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So what's the Chiddush here? What's different in this case that we're being taught over here that wasn't true in the first case? So that's what Tosfos, if you look at Tosfos here, the big Tosfos on the right side, he says, it's in the second, if you go up two lines, in the wide lines, from the bottom of the wide lines, two lines up, it says, Itzruch leshminon, the mandamar hachum ishum kichashadaro, that you have to, the din, or why the Gemara brought it over here, is because of the other opinion, who says, mishum kichashadaro, da filu b'chutz laretz ein shomimlo, that means that it would apply even in chutz laretz. Alright, avale el, davka beretz Yisrael ein shomimlo, but before, when they discuss mishum yishuv eretz Yisrael, that din it only applies in Eretz Yisrael. So one answer of Tosfos is, right, that the reason that we have to bring the Gemara over here is because of the other opinion of kichashadaro, right? Mishum the kichashadaro lo asa biyadaim elu memela ayidei shtifat anar nase, right? So in the case before, right, you can't. There is no application of kichashadaro. Why? Because we only say kichashadaro if a person comes in intentionally plants something there and then diminishes from the land. If that's the case, we say kichashadaro, don't take it out. But in the case of, we discussed before, the flood washed the tree there. So it came there without anybody's intervention. If that's the case, then we're not going to say din of kichashadaro because nobody intentionally planted it there to argue kichashadaro. So there it only applies the din of Yishuv of Eretz Yisrael is the issue. And the mandamar hocha, and over here, but there's an opinion over here that says Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. What's the difference between here and before? It's Yochler Sheminon Shlote Amar Afilu B'chutz Laretz Ain Shumim Lo Mishum Kichashadara. To say that the only din here is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and there is no din of Kichashadara. So that's what Tosa says. According to each opinion, there is a Chiddush in this case. According to the one who says over here, it's Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, he says that's the only din. There's no din of Kichashadara. According to the other opinion, right, there is two dinim. There's a din of Kichashadara, and there's also a din of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. The din in both cases, that means that even when Kichashadaro does not apply, we still will apply the din of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Like the case from the previous Mishnah where the olive tree got washed down, and therefore there's no din of Kichashadaro. Nevertheless, we don't allow you to uproot the tree because of the din of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. All right, so the new Mishnah. A maskir b'ayit l'chaveru b'yimot ha'kshamim. Person who rents out a house to an individual during the rainy season, when we say the rainy season, it means all the way from Sukkot until Pesach. If he rents it out to him during the summer season, then 30 yom, for 30 days. So it's clear that there's some sort of inconsistency in the Mishnah here. Why don't we say the summer is from Pesach until Sukkot? So what's the difference here? The Gemara is going to discuss that. Ubikrachim, in a major city, echad yimot chama v'echad yimot kishamim, whether it's the summer or the winter time, it goes for 12 months. Ubichaniot, when it comes to stores, echad ayarot v'echad kochim, doesn't matter whether it's a large metropolis or a city, you get 12 months. When it comes to a baker, and a dyer, you get 3 years. So Gemara is going to go line by line through the Mishnah and try to understand what this Mishnah is speaking about. So, What's the difference between the winter time? Dechi agar inish beta bimok shamim. When a person rents during the winter time, agar lo kulo yimot kishamim. When he says, I want to rent it from you for the rainy season, he means the entire rainy season, from Sukkot until Pesach. So yimot chamanami. Why, when he says, I want to rent it for the summer or for the dry season? Dechi agar inish beta lo kulo yimot chamo agar. Right? So when he rents it out, he plans to rent it for the whole summer. So why over by the summer we say 30 days, and by the winter we say the entire period? Ella bimot kshamim haynu time. I'll explain to you what's by bimot kshamim. Lo shchiach beta lemegar, that it's not common to find a house to replace the one that you're in. Since it's not easy to find a replacement, we say that if he rents it out, he means to rent it out for the whole winter period, for the whole rainy season. So Gemara says, wait a minute. If that's the case, aim a safe. What are you going to do? The second part of the mission says, "Berkachim, echad yimot chama v'echad yimot kshamim." Doesn't matter whether it's the summer or the winter. Shneim asar chodesh, he gets 12 months. Ve'ilu if he finishes up, meaning that the 12 months ends in the middle of the winter season, you can throw him out. If the whole reasoning for the Mishnah saying that you get it for the entire rainy season is because there's nothing to be found in the rainy season, you can't kick somebody out, then what happens in the city? In the city, it sounds like you get 12 months. Even if the 12 months end in the middle of the rainy season, you can throw him out. So how could that work? He can't find a replacement house. So that can't be the explanation of the Mishnah. So Amar Rav Yehuda, Rav Yehuda explains, Lehodia Ketoni, our Mishnah is talking about notice. How much notice the landlord must give the tenant in order to kick him out. This is what it means. Hamaskir by the Chovero Stam. Someone who rents out without any indication, just rents out a house to his friend. Ein yachol otzio bimotak shamim michag v'ad pesach. Person is not allowed to kick out an individual during the rainy season unless he told him 30 days before the rainy season begins. Meaning that from the 15th of Elul. Meaning if the rainy season begins at Sukkot, at the 15th of Tishrei, that means that unless the landlord gives notice by the 15th of Elul, then the tenant is permitted to stay there all the way until Pesach. You can't kick him out because you don't have 30 days notice. Tanya Nami Hochi, we have a braisa that supports this understanding. Shamru Shloshim, when they said 30 in the Mishnah, when they said 12 months, lo amru lo hodio. It's all about notice. Ukashem shemaskir tzarich lo hodia, kach socher tzarich lo hodia. This is a two-way street. Just like the landlord has to give notice, so too the tenant has to give notice. Why? If you give me notice, then I can replace you or get a better tenant or a tenant to continue. In fact, if you don't give me notice and just go away one day, then I'm going to be left with an empty place. So now, what we have is that the Mishnah is speaking about notice. In a city, you have to give 12 months notice in order to kick somebody out of their location or out of their rental. In a winter season, you have to tell them 30 days before the winter season. It means they buy Tedva Velu. In the summer season, you only have to give 30 days notice in order to kick them out. So that means that during the summer period, just 30 days, and that's sufficient. Now, again, the Gemara says that applies equally to the landlord and the tenant. They both need to give that same amount of notice. Now, Amar Rav Asi, Im Nichnas... Yeah. No, the Gemara had started with the assumption that there is a minimal rental period. So Stam Schirut is the Chodesh. Stam Schirut is for 1 month. But that means that if I rent for a month and it's in the winter season, you can't kick me out now. Once I've rented for that month during the winter season, then I'm staying for the rest of the winter season. Basically, it's a given. And the way Rashi says is whatever he paid for the first month, he'll continue to pay for the subsequent months. All right? So Amar Rav Asi, Im nichnas yom echad bimotak shamim, ene yachol leotzio min achag v'ad pesach. So Rav Asi says, this din that you have to give 30 days notice means that you have to give the entire 30 days notice must be before the rainy season. That means that if you give notice on the 16th of Elul, you can't kick him out for the rainy season because then only 29 days before the rainy season and 1 day goes into the rainy season. It means the entire 30 days must precede, the entire 30 days of notice must precede the rainy season in order. So that means that if you rent to somebody after Tetvav Elul or their rental goes through Tetvav Elul and you don't give them notice by Tetvav Elul, they will continue to live there they're entitled to live there through the entire rainy season. Vahanan Shloshim Yom. Kamar, right? Doesn't the Mishnah say, or Tanan, doesn't our Mishnah say 30 days? It says, Achi Kamar. Im nichnas yom echad bimotak shamim, Mahane Shloshim Yom, Eini Yachol Yotzeo Min Echad V'Agad Pesach. Right, if any one of these days, I guess I jumped the gun explaining Ravasi. Ravasi really just says, like, even if he's one day into the rainy season, right, then you can't kick him out. Gemara says, well, he says he needs 30 days. Of course, one day, no. So Gemara says, no. It means that 30 days is, right, beforehand. You have to have a full block of 30 days before the rainy season in order to have notice. If you only have 29 days, that's not considered 30 days into the rainy season. So by Tetvav Elul, you have that cut off. So this statement of Huna is an incredible statement. Rabbi Huna basically says is that, oh, true, he's obligated to keep him here. Now, the way that means that he has to stay month to month, he's going to stay on. The way Rashi is explaining to it now is that he just keeps whatever rental he paid for the first month, he'll continue to pay for the subsequent months. Rabbi Huna comes along and says, no, after the first original period of skirut is over, he can raise the rent. The landlord has the ability to raise the rent. So yes, true, he has to keep the tenant there, but he can raise the rent on the tenant. So what does that mean? That means basically or effectively you've kicked the tenant out, because Ravuna is saying that if you can raise the rent, you can make it impossible for the tenant to live there. It's true, you have to keep the tenant there, but you can raise the rent so high that the tenant would never stay there. So now the next line in the Gemara, which is the background for a saying today. This is like someone, right, in Lashon Nekiyah, as Rashi explains, someone who grabs him by the beitzim and says, give me your coat. Meaning that you're putting a person in a position, you're putting him over the barrel. There's no, what's the choice of the tenant here? If you allow the landlord to raise the rent, it's as good as saying he can kick him out. Because he can raise it so high where he's going to force the tenant out. So that can't be the case. When it says, lo tzricha diyukor bate, that the ikor bate, the way Rashi explains this is shefsadonikar, that meaning that the market price of rentals has gone up. So if there's a distinguishable and meaningful difference, right, or material difference in market rents versus what this individual is paying, he can move the rent to market rent. So maybe even before, if he rented him below market, once it reaches the point where he's obligated to keep him, even though it's beyond the period of what they agreed to in their rental agreement, though he stays on, he can raise it back to market rates, or if the market rates have gone up, he can move it up to those market rates. He's not obligated to keep it at the original rate. And so based on that, again, to summarize, right, there's notice that must be given in order, both from a landlord standpoint and from the renter standpoint, in order to leave. During this summer period, 30 days is sufficient notice. During the rainy season, it must be 30 days prior to the rain season start in order to be considered notice. That means it has to be given by Tedvav Elul in the 15th Elul. In large cities, right, and other krachim and such places, you have to give 12 months notice in order to tell the individual that he has to leave, or to tell him to evict him from the apartment. Is that, again, that it's very, very difficult to find housing in these large cities. So you have to give 12 months notice for the individual to find a new location and to be able to procure a new rental. So 12 months is considered to be a sufficient time. Okay. Pshita, nafala beta, if the landlord's house fell down, amalei lo adif minai, he can say to the renter, you're no better than me. Meaning that if the renter's in there, the landlord can kick the renter out and say, listen, I don't have a house. Better, I can live in the house. You go look for a house. So now it's clear, and Rashi points out over here, Rashi says, hoyovi igiaz mano motzio. This has to be at the termination of the lease. I mean, it has to be at the end of the skirut. It has to be at the end of what was their agreed upon period, even though he hasn't given him proper notice. So even though he hasn't given proper notice, but he's reached the end or the termination of their lease agreement. So despite the fact that he hasn't given him notice, he can throw him out. Why? Because the landlord can basically say to him, listen, either I'm going to be looking for a property or you're going to be looking for a property. The reason I have to give you notice is so that you have time to look for a property. Right now, I don't have any time to look because I just got trapped in this position. So no better, one of us is going to look, and I own the property, so better you look than me, so you're out. And he can do that. He's allowed to kick him out. That, the Gemara says, is a given. Now, Zavne, or Orte, Oyave Bematana, if he sells the landlord sells the property, or gives it, it becomes a Yerusha, passed to his child, Oyave Bematana, or he gives it as a gift, then it's clear, Amalei, the tenant can say, Lo yidift migafra datamine. The tenant can say to the new landlord, you can't change the terms. I mean, that you are bound by the same terms as the original landlord, because the landlord beforehand can only sell you the rights that he had. And whatever rights he had, he's selling to you. And if beforehand the landlord was obligated to give me notice and was obligated over that period of time, so too are you. So that's the Gemara says is a given. I'm a klalalei de bray, right? If he gives it, if his son gets married, chazinan, we look. Ihava efshalo da. If he had sufficient time, meaning it wasn't a shotgun wedding, he had sufficient time to give notice to this individual to leave, ibayalei lo de, then he should have given notice, and he can't kick him out. Vilo, if he wouldn't have sufficient time to tell him, amalei lo adif minai, he can again say to the tenant, look, you're no better than me. I have to provide a place for my son to live. He's getting married, right? And you're at the end of your lease. And, okay, true, I didn't give you notice, but I'm also in a bind. I have also the same situation where I have no notice, and I got to find a place for my son. So we're gonna give preference to my son over you. If someone has to look, you look, not me. And so therefore he can evict him, he can take him out, even though he hasn't given him the sufficient notice. So Amar la Hau Gavra, the Zavin Arba de Chamra. He went ahead and he purchased a boat full of wine. Lo Ashkach Duchto Lotve. He got to the port, he was unloading the ship, and he had no place to put all these barrels of wine. So Amar la Lahai Itita, Itlach Duchto Logre. Do you have a location? Do you have a warehouse? Do you have something that you could rent to me? Amar le Lo. She said no, meaning that the truth is that she did have a place, but she didn't want to rent it to him, so she says no. So what does this guy do? Azol Kacho. He gets married to her. He goes in and has kiddushin with her. Yavele. So then she gave it to him, because now they're married, husband and wife. She gives him the place to rent it out. Right? Yavele Duchto Laile. So to bring in the barrels. Azol Abete. This guy went home. Kotav Lagita. He writes her a get. Shadarla and sent it to her. Azla Ihi. So now, what this guy did was he couldn't find a place to put all, he's going to lose a ton of money, he couldn't find the wine. He knew this woman had a location to rent, but she wasn't willing to rent it to him. So what does he do instead? He marries her. When he marries her, he gets a hold of the location, puts his wine in there. As soon as he gets home, what does he do? He sends her a divorce, because he only married her to get the location. So now he sends her a divorce letter. So this woman was not going to take this sitting down. So what does she do? She goes ahead. Ihi, Azla Ihi, she went. Agra Shokulai, she hired some schleppers. She sold some of the wine that was in the warehouse. She sold some of the wine, hired schleppers. She took it out and put it on the street. She took his barrels and she evicted him, or took away, terminated the agreement, and threw all his barrels out onto the street. So Ravuna says, like he did, it should be done to him. Gmulo Yeshuv Berosho. Right, that which he did to others now is returned on his head. He treated this woman, he married her only to get the hold of the property, and then he divorces her. So this woman pays him back in full. She throws out his stuff, and so he's going to lose as well. So Gemara says, "Lo mi bay chatzer de lo kaimel agra." We're not even talking about a property that she wouldn't have rented otherwise, meaning that she wasn't planning on renting out the property, and because of the marriage, she gave it to him. Not even that case. Ela afilu chatzer de kaimel agra. Even if it was a property that she otherwise would have rented out, and she said no to him. Because Amarle, she can say to him, I'm willing to rent it to anybody else, but I don't want to rent it to you. The damit alai, because you are like to me, ki arya arba. You are like a lion in waiting. You are a lion that's waiting to pounce, and I don't want to rent it out to you. Meaning that she has the right to say, like what she said before, even though it was available for rent, she has the right to say to this individual, no, I don't want you in here, or I don't want to rent it to you. That is her... she has that ability, or that is her prerogative in terms of renting out the property, who she rents it out to, and she could deny him access. And therefore, she has the right again afterwards to throw him out, because she wasn't obligated to rent it to him, and the only reason he got it was because he married her, and then he divorced her, so she can toss him out, because she could say, I don't want you as my tenant. Now, the Gemara is going to explain the last piece of the Mishnah. Right, for these craftsmen or these workers, it's 3 years. Tana mipnei kifan miruba, because their receivables are very big and very long dated. So basically, this teaches us what the issue is at the end of the Mishnah. At the end of the Mishnah, it says when it comes to stores, you always have to give 12 months' notice to kick them out. Why do you have to give 12 months notice to kick out a storekeeper? Because the storekeeper gives out credit to the people in the neighborhood. He has receivables outstanding. So people pay back when they pass the store, and when they're in the neighborhood, they go and pay it back. If you kick him out of his storefront, then the people aren't going to know where to pay it back. He's not going to be able to collect his accounts receivables. Therefore, you have to give him 12 months notice so he knows to start collecting his receivables and not giving out credit anymore. So that, the Gemara says, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, when it comes to a baker and a dyer, then we give them 3 years. Why? Because they give out large credits. They give out tremendous credits, and it takes them 3 years to get it paid back. Their account receivables are longer dated, and it takes them 3 years to wipe it down. So therefore, we say you have to give him 3 years' notice so that he knows to collect on all his receivables and not enter into new credit agreements, not to give out or extend credit anymore. Okay, next Mishnah. A maskir bayit lechavero, someone who rents out a house to his friend. A maskir chayav, what are the obligations of the landlord? Obligations of the landlord are to provide a delet, a door, nagar, with a bolt, ubimanul, right, and with a lock. Ubechol davar shemaase uman. Anything that takes a craftsman to fix or to put into place, that is what the landlord is obligated in. Aval davar shenu maase uman, something that can be done by an ordinary individual, a layperson, then a socher oseu, then the renter is obligated, the tenant is obligated to take care of that. So again, if the renter stuffs the toilet, that's his problem. He's got to fix it. He's got to plunge it out. That's his issue. On the other hand, if there's something that's wrong that requires a craftsman to come in and fix, then that's the obligation of the landlord. Hazevel shel balabait. Again, this will be discussed in the Gemara. All the zevel belongs to the dung, belongs to the balabait. Vein l'socher, the socher only entitled to yotzei min haTorah min haKirayim. That which comes out of the stove and the ovens, that the afar, the afer, the ashes that come out of there, that he's entitled to, bilvat. That's the only thing he's entitled to. Now, Tana Rabbanan, a maskir bayit lechavero, person who rents out a house to his friend, maskir chayav lamid lo daltot, he's put up doors, liftoach lo chalanot, to open windows for him, lechazek lo letikra, to strengthen the roof, to ensure that the roof is, that there's integrity to the roof, lismoch lo kara, to put in crossbeams if any of them are bad, visocher, the tenant is obligated, chayav lasot lo sulam, to make a ladder, or I guess it seems to be here, either to move internally from the different floors, or outside to move to the upper floor. Lasot lo ma'akeh. Ma'akeh is chuva of the socher, the chuvat adar, that to put a fence around the top of the roof of the house or any high position where there's danger of someone being injured, he is obligated to put up the ma'akeh. Lasot lo marzev. This is very interesting. A gutter. The gutters are the obligation of the tenant. The way Rashi explains it, these gutters were pieces of wood that they used to have at the edge of the walls that used to push the water away from the house so it wouldn't affect the foundations or the house itself. And he says that anybody could put those pieces of wood there or replace those pieces of wood, so it was something that could be done by a layperson. Latiach et gago, and he also has to seal the roof to ensure that the roof doesn't leak. That's the obligation of the tenant. Bomine Rav Sheshit, mezuzah ami. Who is obligated to put up the mezuzah? Gemara says, mezuzah? That's a question. Amar Misharshia, mezuzah chuvat adarhi. That mezuzah is always the obligation of the one or the individual who's living there. It's not a question. It's not landlord-tenant. It's about anybody, whoever lives there is obligated in mezuzah. Ela makom mezuzah almi. No, the question is not whether who's obligated in mezuzah. It's clear that the socher, the tenant, the renter, the user of the house, is obligated to put up the mezuzah. The question is the makom, the placement of the mezuzah. And here we mean a mezuzah, not the mezuzah like the klaf, but mezuzah means the doorpost. Who has to provide the doorpost in which to put the mezuzah? Similar of Sheisha Tinitua. We learned this already. Davar Shein Masimun Disocher Oseu. Right? So that anything that's not done can be done by any ordinary person, then the socher is obligated to do it. Bahai Nami La Maseumanu. This is also not a Maseuman. Why is that? Efshar hu begufta dekanyo, that the way the underlying assumption of the Gemara originally was that the way that you put up the mezuzah was that you had to carve into the wall, you had to dig into the stone, you had to carve out the stone and then place the mezuzah. That is a maseh uman, that requires a craftsman. So that would be the obligation of the mazkir. The Gemara says, yeah, no, you know, that's not the obligation of the mazkir. Why? Because it's an alternative. To put up a mezuzah, you don't necessarily have to carve into the stone. You could put it in a holder and place it onto the door. You take it on a kanya, place it on the door, and that'll be sufficient to classify it as b'mekayim the mitzvah mezuzah. If that's the case, then even a layperson can do that. If a layperson can do it, then it's not classified as mezuzah. Then it'll be the obligation of the socher to provide, obviously, the holder, right? Not that it's not the obligation of the maskir to provide or to do the crafts, get a craftsman in there to provide or dig it into the wall so that the mezuzah can be placed into the wall. Right now, the Gemara says, Tan Rabbanan, a maskir by the chavero, al ha-socher la-sol mezuzah, that's what we just learned before, that the socher, the renter, is obligated to put up mezuzah, ukushu yotze, when he leaves the house, lo yitlena biyado, he has to leave the mezuzot behind, biyotze, he has to go out without the mezuzot. U-minachri, notla biyado biyotze, if he's renting from an achri, or there's a suspicion that an achri will be the next renter in the house, or the renter, whatever, somehow there's going to be a nachri there who could be mezazel in the mezuzot, then notla biyado, then he can take the mezuzot viyotze, and then he can leave. Umase be'achat shenatla biyado viyatza, somebody took mezuzot with him and left, v'kavar ishto shtei manav, he buried his wife and his two children, so the Gemara is talking about the severity, right, of doing this. Where it says, mase listor, you bring an example to undermine what you just said. You just said that if a nachri is going to be there, you can take it. And then you bring a maaseh that when he takes it, his wife and his children died. But it says, no, I'm a Rosh Hashanah. It's going on the first case. The first case in the Braisa, which is you're not allowed to take when it's a Jew. If you do take it, then there's this severe punishment that's involved. So Tosis over here explains the reason why a person is not permitted to take the mezuzah with him when he leaves. Says it's actually in the previous Amud on the end of Kufam and Amud Bet, he says, because when a lefisha mazikim baim babayit shein bo mezuzah, that these mazikim come into a house where there's no mezuzah, ukshinot la, if you remove the mezuzah and you allow these mazikim to come in, it's ke'ilu mazikotan shidoru babayit. It's as if you're being mazik, the new owner, the new person who's coming to live there, because you're allowing these mazikim to come in by taking off the mezuzot. That's one issue that Tosfos explains. And the second Tosfos, which is very important, is the Tosfos over here. It says, Mikan Nira, this is the top of Kuf Bet Amud Aleph, Kamosha Perish Rashi. It sounds over here like the Perish of Rashi. There is a machlokus between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam in the Gemara in Menachot about how one places the mezuzah on the wall. So it sounds from here, he says, from our Gemara over here, it sounds like Rashi's Pshat, which is that the way to place the mezuzah is standing upright. The way you place the mezuzah on the wall is upright, and that's why you need a gufta dekanya. Why would you need a holder to hold the mezuzah unless it's standing upright? On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam believes that the way one puts the mezuzah on the door is munach, is laying flat or laying down. Right? So that you place it miyushav, laying down, kamo sefer Torah, like you place a sefer Torah on the Aron. Below Mu'mad, they're not standing up. So from Rashi's interpretation that says Mu'mad, that has to be upright, that makes sense that you need a gufti kanya to hold it upright. On the other hand, if it's going to be munach, it's going to be laying down, right? If it's going to be laying down, then what do you need a gufti kanya for? You just place it down and it could sit there. So Tosfos in the end says, no, even according to Rabbeinu Tam, who says it's laying down, you could still say you need a requirement of gufti kanya. Why do you need a gufti kanya? Because lo techale miluchluchita kotel, you still have to protect the mezuzah. If you leave the mezuzah unprotected, even if it's laying down, nevertheless, it's going to be exposed to the elements. If it's exposed to the elements, it's going to ruin the klav, it's going to ruin the mezuzah. So you need a gufta dekanya, not for the halachic reason of the placement of the mezuzah, but rather because of the need to protect the mezuzah. And that's why we're talking about a gufta dekanya here. Even according to Rabbeinu Tam, who says that it could be laying down, still we want a gufta dekanya, we want some sort of protective shield to ensure that the mezuzah does not get ruined. This machlokes, we'll see this later on when we get to Gemara Menachot, this machlokes between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam about the placement of the mezuzah, whether it should be upright or it should be horizontal. And that's where the derivative or the derivation of our minhag to place the mezuzah on a slight angle to try to accomplish or to at least be choshesh for both the opinion of Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam. Okay, we'll stop over here.